The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona Tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode of Writing Excuses has been brought to you by our listeners, patrons, and friends. If you would like to learn how to support this podcast, visit www.patreon.com/writingexcuses.
Hey, listeners. We want your input on season 20, which, I have to be honest, does not sound like a real number. What elements of the craft do you want us to talk about? What episode or core concept do you use or reference or recommend the most? Or what are you just having trouble with? After 20 seasons, we've talked about a lot of things. What element of writing do you wish we'd revisit for a deeper dive on the podcast? Email your ideas to podcast@writingexcuses.com. This is just a warning. Max and Amal are really amazing, so we know that this podcast is going to go very, very long. This is not 15 minutes long because they are that smart. Season 19, Episode 16. This is Writing Excuses.
An interview on voice with Max and Amal.
I'm Mary Robinette.
And I'm Dong Wan. And this week, we are very lucky to have two guests with us. As you all know, we've spent the last several weeks diving into This Is How You Lose the Time War and doing a close read and talking about different aspects of how voice is used in the book, how the different characters are distinguished from each other, and all these different aspects of the way in which voice is very much put forward in the book. And we are so lucky today to be able to talk to the authors themselves, Max Gladstone and Amal El-Motar, who are both here with us today. Max, do you want to go ahead and introduce yourself to our audience?
Sure. Hi, I'm Max Gladstone. I am one of the co-authors of This Is How You Lose the Time War, and also the author of, I guess, about 10 books, probably notably The Craft Sequence, of which the most recent book, Wicked Problems, is just out maybe a week ago as you listen to
this. And Amal.
Hi, I'm Amal El-Mohtar, and I am also the other author on This Is How You Lose the Time War. I'm also a critic. I write a column for the New York Times on science fiction and fantasy. I review stuff there more generally. I write short stories and poetry. And I just today, this is time of recording, not time of release, finished a book that I turned in. It's hard to say that because it's a revision, but I just have been convincing myself it's a book. It's called The River Has Roots.
It Ooh. Is a book, and we are very excited about it. It's going to be great.
I am making, I want this. If only I knew your agent to convince them to send me a copy when it was ready for people to read it.
Yes, when it is ready, you absolutely will be getting one. I'll make a note to remind your agent. So,
yes.
What I kind of wanted to start with for Time War is, you know, obviously we picked this book because the voice is very strong. And one of the unique things about this, you know, a lot of co-written projects have a goal of blending voice where you cannot tell the difference between them, right? You look at something like The Expanse, for example, written by James S.A. Corey, which is two authors, but there's no sense of a difference in voice from chapter to chapter. A lot of times people are working together to try and blend it and smooth it out. You guys did exactly the opposite, right?
Yes.
I think of both of you individually as incredibly voicey writers, right? Like Max, the craft sequence has such a specific tonality and specificity in the writing. And Amal, your short fiction has like this lyricism to it. And seeing that emerge in Time War was really interesting. How did you guys think about approaching that in terms of each of you bringing two very different modes of writing to this project?
I mean, so partly the project emerged from the fact that we wanted to preserve our two different voices, essentially. Like, we wanted to make a virtue of the fact that we recognized we had very different voices and styles and modes. I mean, Max had written several novels and I had written only short stories, and that in and of itself sort of constrains, or not constrains, but, you know, defines the voice that goes into that. And we'd also been writing each other letters by hand. And so as a consequence, the fact that you have a voice and sort of nothing else in a letter was a means to kind of going, hey, how do we want to get both our voices in here without trying to make them be not our respective voices? What if we had them write letters? So it really just like the project itself kind of came out of the fact that we wanted to preserve our voices.
Absolutely. I think that the correspondence that we'd maintained for about a year or so before starting to write Time War played a bridging role, because we'd both developed a voice in our own letters toward one another, and we understood a kind of dynamic and play in letter writing that also was not about obscuring or rubbing away the standout aspects of one or another voice. When you're writing, when you're exchanging letters with someone, you don't think, oh, I need to make my voice in the letter match theirs. You might sometimes think, oh, wow, that letter really moved me, so now I feel a desire to confess or to reveal something in confidence to match. There's a sense of not exactly competition, but of generative play.
Yeah,
very much. When you're exchanging letters. And I think the entire structure of the project, though, came from the fact that we recognized our two voices were pretty different, and yet that we had many of the same concerns bringing us to the page. How to preserve what was valuable and create a structure where the commonalities could reinforce one another.
Yeah.
And that suggested two different characters. That suggested not overwriting each other, but instead responding to one another.
I think one last thing I'll say on that too is that the place that this project had in our friendship, I think, was also a kind of definitional aspect, because the two of us were getting to know each other and doing that thing that you do in an early friendship where you're sort of unpacking yourselves to each other in ways that are about revelation and connection and stuff across and because of your differences. I think that invited a form of writing a project together that was about mutual discovery, as opposed to kind of the meld. I mean, the melding is a consequence of the discovery, if that makes sense. But mm-hmm. but to start with two voices that are very different and then bring them into a kind of harmony with each other that doesn't obliterate them was, to me, part of it too.
And when I come to read two author projects, I am often picking apart who wrote what. I have a pretty solid, I've only read a couple of the Expanse novels, but I have a pretty solid guess as to who writes which sections on a section by section level. It took me, you know, as a kid, it took me four or five reads through Good Omens before I thought I had a really solid read on what parts were Neil's and what parts were Terry's. but that's always fascinated me, how writers can be almost in the same zone and then also nevertheless revealing themselves. Things like word choice and joke cadence. I love it.
I'm curious. I really want to dig into things like word choice and joke cadence. But kind of before we do that, I want to acknowledge that there are three voices at least happening, or four, depending on how you want to define it, because there's the voices that are in the letters, but there's also the narrative. And I'm curious, like, were you thinking about keeping your voices separate in the narrative parts as well, or were you focused on that more in the letter, the epistolary portions?
That is such a good question. I don't think we discussed that part particularly. I think that definitely that was the area where I felt our respective styles were most coming to the fore, in that especially early on, mine were very, I always think of mine as very compressed and Max's as more expanded. And or expansive, and that those are two things that sort of change over the course of the book. But we didn't. I don't think that we set out as we were writing it to be like we're keeping our voices really different in the third person sections. How did you feel about that, Max?
I took a pretty strong "Let Bartlett be Bartlett" approach to the project. I figured there was no way that we were going to end up producing scenes or letters that sounded like one another, unless this did end up happening, we were specifically sort of in friendly competition with one another a little bit. Or as things moved on, it's like, oh, Mal really got me with that scene. I wonder if I can do something that's like that, but in my own style. So there was a little bit of trying to cap one another's verses, I think, that started to happen midway through. In part, the virtue of the compressed composition, we did the first two-thirds or so of this book in a really short period of time, like a couple of weeks, basically, over a writing retreat for the first draft, meant that we were drawing on a lot of influences and a lot of deep and broad roots in genre storytelling. So I was pulling off of a lot of new wave science fiction. The first section feels very much like a Zelazny riff to me, especially out of Creatures of Light and Darkness or maybe some early Delaney. There's Le Guin that pops in there. You've got a William Gibson sort of quote in one section, Amal, there's the cyberpunk sort of hacking bit. There's the riddle game, which I think came out of a conversation. The sort of computer riddle game might have come out of a conversation the two of us had about Michael Moorcock's Iron Dragon's Daughter. There's the book is extremely referential, and I found myself leaning on the broader languages of science fiction and of fantasy in order to sell the many prose scenes so quickly. So you could orient somebody into a new scene, a new genre, a new corner of this massive time-shifting multiverse rapidly. And I felt like you were doing much the same, but since we were coming so much from our own experiences, things that we recognized, our own weird interests, they naturally had a very full and personal voice to them.
They did. So two things. One, the sort of capping verses thing, right? There are so many things in Time War that you are referencing that either at the time or still currently, I don't have any experience of. I have read exactly one Zelazny novel and you gave it to me and it was A Night in the Lonesome October, which is not in any way... That is an extraordinarily perfect book, but it's not in the tone or universe of what you are doing here. I had never listened to, never deliberately or consciously listened to Bob Dylan. But when you throw in everyone's building them big ships and boats, and then it's like As the Prophets Say became a thing that I just kind of started, you know, bouncing back to you and stuff.
I'd never listened to Three Dead Trolls in a Baggie.
No, exactly. This is the thing. So my references were also very niche and opaque and probably much more rooted in my benighted doctoral research. So there was a lot of 19th century British romanticism in there. There's a lot of just a lot of like my stuff, you know. So I feel like what we kind of did was give each other room to bring all of our toys out of our respective closets and like pile them onto the ground between us. Yeah. and make the dinosaur talk to the robot and make I feel like that's kind of more what we did rather than decide that we wanted to follow two different things. I feel like we created a space for each other to bring our respective nonsenses to.
This is just something that I kind of want to draw a line under for our listeners, that bringing your own personal taste, this mm-hmm. is something we keep talking about season after season, that your own experiences, your own taste, the references that mean something to you are part of building a voice that is specifically yours. Mm-hmm. And things that even when you're trying to match someone else, you can't do unless you have that same, you can bring that same experience. And it's something that makes it joyful. Mm-hmm.
There's a term in literary criticism called anxiety of influence, right? I can't remember who it comes from, but it's this anxiousness of I'm making this too close to X. I read Y, and now my book has too much of that in it. And what I love about Time War is how much you both just hang a lantern on it, right? Like that repeated refrain of, as the prophets say, or just like the direct quotes, the million references that are happening throughout, and the way in which you flatten all culture and you're welcome to make a literary 19th century romantic poetry reference and a, you know, pop song from the early 2000s reference with the same equal weight, because it is through the perspective of these two people to whom it's all ancient history to them that are all figuring it out. And so, you know, I think what I was really surprised by on rereading the book is when we talk about Time War, when we think about it, you know, when people are tweeting about it, it is in the context of this like lush romantic story, right? Between these two people, this grand scope love story, this like queer romance and all of that. And I genuinely forgot how funny this book is. Like, how did the two of you think about the humor and the referentiality and like the like almost like Monty Python-ness of it sometimes? Like, how deliberate was that in you working on the project, or how did you work that into the voice of the novel?
Can I say it is such a boon to, I have never thought of myself ever as a comic writer, as like someone who could write something funny, you know. I think I have an enormous, like, I cannot stress how enormous my respect is for people who are and who do and who are comics and who like do comedy in general. Like, it blows my mind. It is like watching magicians as far as I'm concerned. But the huge boon that I felt this project did is that if you are trying to make the person sitting across from you laugh, suddenly you are. Suddenly you are a comic. Suddenly there's no anxiety about it. You're with someone who you trust, and you are sharing all your goofy, weird stuff that you have been talking about over the course of your year-long correspondence. And if you're just trying to make each other laugh, that's really what I felt it was. Like, we kept, especially in the sort of player versus player section of the book, you know, just kind of back and forth. I think we were both thinking of Spy versus Spy, the comics, and how those are funny. Mm-hmm. We're thinking of how, you know, outdoing each other and being like being in that kind of competition.
It's like a Tom and Jerry aspect to Red and Blue, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so just kind of like we would talk about like how to set up a sort of situation which could result in a certain, I don't know if we talked about punchlines. I was about to say punchline. I'm not totally sure if that's true now, except like, you know, the wax seal pun and stuff like that. That definitely took some engineering, I think, like, or if we had just, you know, mentioned it in passing. But it's like the fact
there's
that...
There's a lot of like, oh my God, can we get away with this?
Yeah. But because of the formal layer of it, right? Because you have this layer between you guys writing the line and the reader receiving it because it's meant to be sent to this other person, that it's like you can get away with some jokes that you wouldn't be able to get away with if it was just straight narration, right? It's because it's one of them trying to impress the other by making this very silly joke.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, things is said in dialogue or in letter you can get away with in ways that you can't in narration.
Yeah.
I also, again, want to say just a very useful thing, a very useful tool is the specificity of audience.
Yeah.
Like that, the way you tell Red Riding Hood if you're telling it to kindergartners is entirely different than if you're doing a Red Riding Hood retelling for like Apex Magazine, mm-hmm. which is all science fiction horror. Those are, even if you have the same beats, it's just tonally so different. And thinking about, I one of the things that works really well for me when I'm writing is to think about a specific person
yeah.
that I am writing for.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, one of the super secret texts of this book, as far as I'm concerned, was that it was laser focused. My sections were laser focused on being written for Amal, just sitting there.
Yeah.
It's so easy to let the world into the back of your head telling you what you should write, whether that's, you know, concerns about being sufficiently literary or sufficiently science fictional or fantastical, or being enough like the books that you read when you were 14, or being too much like the books that you read when you were 14, that the chattering can overwhelm the authentic desire that's bringing you to the page to write about this weird little guy or weird little gal.
Yeah.
And I think it was so liberating to not care in the composition, whether it worked for absolutely anyone except for you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you felt the same way.
Yeah, no, I did. I very much. I have this sort of awe of comics and stuff like that. I don't feel like it's a similar, like it's not the same vibe to imagine myself on a stage making an audience laugh as it is being in a living room with my friend trading jokes back and forth. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Which is also a question of voice. I think, you know, there is so little in Time War, I think, where we are ever cheating towards an audience. I really feel like we are so, that we were so when we were writing it, just, I mean, literally the physicality of sitting across a table from each other so that whenever I looked up from my screen, I was seeing you, you know.
I start cackling when I'm writing, like you
yeah!
hear that. And
Yeah. There was just so much of like, oh, I'm so excited for the bit where we like swap laptops and read what we've written and stuff. And get the reaction. And it's such a different thing than to be so in your own head, imagining an audience that doesn't exist. And I mean, gosh, when we were writing Time War, we hadn't yet like signed with Dongwon either. Like we didn't know it was going to be a book. I didn't.
Weren't you working with Dongwon already?
No.
Not yet.
No, we started.
I think it was like the first thing you guys sent me.
We were. I'm sorry to belabor this timeline, but it is like rooted in my head.
It's all timelines, man.
We started writing it in June 2016, which I know because of Brexit, which happened while we were doing it. We finished it in December of 2016, and Dongwon, I signed with you in November of 2016. So it was the bit where Max and I were sitting across from each other, that was all in the summer. I didn't know you were going to be my agent yet. Didn't know this was like how this was going to be a project that moved in the world. Didn't know if it could be a book because it was a novella, like had really no idea what it was going to look like outside of our collaboration in that moment. And I think that
this is one of the few things in my career where I felt 100% confident that it was going to be a book and it was going to be great. Like I had no doubts whatsoever. Everything else is doubts to the sky.
I think that confidence comes through in the book. But yeah, I think I would love to get into more of the details of the mechanics about how you get across some of these different aspects. But let's take a quick break before we dive into those details.
Hey, writers. Are you thinking about learning a new language? I think exploring the world, experiencing other cultures, and being able to communicate with people outside your everyday experience lets you create richer, better stories. A great way to do that is with Rosetta Stone, a trusted expert for over 30 years with millions of users and 25 languages offered. They use an immersive technique which leads to fast language acquisition. It's an intuitive process that helps you really learn to speak, listen, and most of all, think in the language you're trying to learn. They also feature true accent speech recognition technology that gives you feedback on your pronunciation. It's like having a voice coach in your home. Learn at home or on the go with a desktop and mobile app that let you download and access lessons even when you're offline. And it's an amazing value. A lifetime membership gives you access to all 25 languages, including Spanish, French, Italian, German, Japanese, and, of course, Korean. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, Writing Excuses listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Okay, my thing of the week is a 2017 game called Hollow Knight, which is amazing. I started playing it over the holidays and was when I was sick, and I just fell into it. And I thought, well, you know, I'm very late to this game. And then shortly, like halfway through it, realized as I was talking to Max that Max had also recently finished it, and we had both kind of come to this 2017 game at the same time. It's tremendous. It's a 2D side-to-side platformer in a kind of Metroidvania way. This might not mean anything to you if you don't speak the language of video games. All that I will say about it is it's a tremendously satisfying, beautifully designed, beautiful to look at, beautiful to play game in which you are a small bug that is a knight, wandering through this kingdom called Hollow Nest, trying to confront this strange plague that has turned everyone into weird, mindless creatures. And then you're getting the lore of this kingdom. You're getting it in like all these beautiful bits here and there. You're meeting weird, cool characters. You are thinking about life and existence. it's just a gorgeous game. I have spent many hours playing it, and it's just something that feels very endlessly generative. I love talking to people about it. I love weirdly quoting the invented language that's in it. I keep going, Bapanada. at people. Or by people, I mean my spouse. But anyway, it's so gorgeous.
She just sounds so wonderfully bored when she says it. It's great. I really care about these two bugs' marriage, like much more than I care about many fictional characters' marriages.
Very true. But yeah, Hollow Knight. It is super great. It's from an indie team. It's from 7 years ago. And it cost us a princely sum of $18 Canadian to buy on Switch. So it has given us a tremendous amount of enjoyment.
My thing this week is a novel by Terry Bisson called Talking Man, which I bought on the internet after seeing the first two pages or three pages of it going around Blue Sky and just having the back of my skull blown off by reading them. Just intense, deep, weird American fantasy about a wizard from the end of time who's also like a kind of, long-bearded, big-belly dude who runs a junkyard and has a few acres of tobacco and, in the rural Kentucky. Amazing road novel, Americana fantasy with sort of slipstream engines and people sliding from one reality to another. And it's wonderful. I touched on a lot of this material in a book I wrote called Last Exit. And it's wild to pick up a novel from 30, 35 years ago and see something that's playing with a lot of the same themes and characters and energy and see how differently it worked out then and to notice the correspondences. Very generative, very cool, and electric.
So I want to now dive into some of the real nitty-gritty of this. So we're going to talk about language. You said that that there's differences in imagery and cadence from author to author. So we're gonna start on page one, because one of the things that I loved in this book all the way through is the way you are using color, and the way the colors serve as metaphor. So it's not just their names, red and blue, but also the things that you choose to point out. So like on the first page, when Red wins, she stands alone, blood slicks her hair, and just, immediately painting her with literal red. And farther down on that page, after a mission comes a grand and final silence, her weapons and armor fold into her like roses at dusk. And you use these places of these spots of color kind of all the way through the book. What I'm curious about is like how conscious that was, because there's another point deeper into the book, and I'm like, was this on purpose? Because if it is, it's awesome, and if it's not, it's still awesome, and I will take it. There's another point deeper into the book in chapter 8 where Blue is in London next and describes it as sepia tinted skies strung with dirigibles, the viciousness of empire acknowledged only as a rosy backdrop glow. And I was like, is that on purpose? Is that on purpose that Blue is starting to get infected by red? Because if it's not, just say, yes, I'm so glad you noticed that. And if it is, it's like either way, it works really well. Oh.
Well, yes, I'm so glad you noticed that. there were a few things. So I know that from my part, actually, I don't know, Max, you start.
You started talking first. You got to go first.
I just also want to acknowledge for the listeners and to buy them time to think that this is a book that they wrote 5 years ago, and I know that my awareness of my decision process from 5 years ago is I'm frequently like, what? That's a sentence that I wrote. So
here's a funny thing about that, actually. So to me, in that I actually do recall my state of mind while I was writing that scene. There's so much about this particular book that, because of the experience of writing it, I think so much of my mindset or my decisions has actually stayed with me in ways that are surprising. But I know that when I was, so a thing about me is that I am quite synesthetic in general when I write. So there are always sort of inadvertent correspondences for me between sound and color and texture. I'm often doing truly absurd things to light, which I extremely realized in the thing that I most recently finished writing. And so to me, in that moment, the rosy was doing like six things in my head at the same time. One of them was wanting to evoke the smell of roses because of the tea house, because of the moment in London that was, because of Empire and Attar and Damascus and all of that. Another was visual, which is like the talking about it being a sepia tinted place was because I was slightly roasting steampunk stuff, and which I, you know, enjoy. I enjoy problematically and whatever, but a huge part of me roasting this is roasting my enjoyment of this thing. Like knowing the thing is the product of truly vicious and terrible polities in the world, and yet it has produced these beauties that are so sensory and stuff like that. And within all of that is red as well. Like there's this, now I really don't think that I'm trying to remember now, does Blue ever call her Rose? I don't think so. Because I never really, I don't know. No, actually this is a place where I'm not 100% sure now. When I was quite confident.
I don't remember her doing so, but it's possible she does at some point and it just didn't stick. But, you know, there's so many synonyms
in there. Yeah, I also don't remember it. I suspect that she doesn't, because I feel like that would have been something you'd pull away from as being too...
She does.
Is it a Burns reference?
Chapter 10, My Red, Red
My
Rose.
My Red, Red Rose. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's the Burns.
Okay.
Yeah.
Burns,
okay.
Yeah.
So then yes. Ultimately.
There we go.
But yeah.
But that's the only time.
But this is the thing. It's like, what I want to make clear is I wasn't writing it going, this is a reference to red. It was like, there is a palette that is coming together from the experience of the previous letters. And it, that palette is sensory across a few different senses. And I'm trying to make this one word evoke all of those things. That, if that makes sense.
But I love that that idea of layering, and it's something that, you know, when we talk about muscular writing, that this is often what we're talking about, is a word that is doing more than one thing. And I do think that that's something that you often see coming out of short story or poetry.
Yeah.
Because we have to be so compressed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to go back to that word compress, because Amal, when you were talking about your style, your voice, and Max's voice, I think you referred to Max's voice as feeling more expansive to you, and yours is, I think you said compressed is the word that I remember.
Mm-hmm.
And it struck me because I think of you two in the opposite way. Actually.
Oh, interesting.
I think of Max, and particularly in the voice of Red, as being very clipped, very... muscular in a slightly different way, muscular in like a almost like noirish kind of tone, that like short sentences, a little bit more, you know, sort of firm endings to things. There's still an expansiveness to it in the sense that by word count and certain descriptions, but there is more of that closed offness that comes from Red and sort of implies her world building versus Blue's perspective, which is a little bit more rambling and circuitous and all of these things. Even though I think I see what you mean by condensed in terms of workout, but I'm curious how those two words, like when you're approaching your voice and how you think about your voice and maintaining it or developing and nurturing it, you know, how does that playing in there in terms of that expansiveness and that compression?
So what I meant when I said that was there's like a metaphor in my head, which I keep kind of coming back to think of Max's writing versus mine. And it's a question of, sort of strengths. Like, to me, a thing that Max does that I aspire to is describing humans in action in an area in a way that is visual, visible, and embodied. And something that I feel like my strategies for describing, you know, people in a place doing stuff is one that is extremely evocative instead. Like, I find it very difficult to actually do the thing that Max does. And whenever I read something that Max has written in a project that we've done together, I'm always like, how do I do that? how did he do that? And how can I do that? And so the metaphor that I come to is that I feel like I'm picking up a shell on the beach and looking deep inside it at the nacre and the light hitting it and smelling it and touching it and like going through the memories that it evokes in me and stuff like that. Whereas Max has this capacity to describe the beach, like to just like look up from the shell and actually see the environment and stuff. So that's what I meant by compressed versus expansive. It's really like a compression of vision, if that makes sense in my mind, and an expansion of vision.
I think of this in terms of, I think of my approach to scene work in terms of Go a lot, the game of Race Your Bottom. So you've got I'm not a very good player. So as I make this analogy, those of you who are good players, I apologize. It's a game of alternating turns to create structures and space on a board. So the goal, one of the major goals, is to do as much with each individual stone, each individual move that you're making to create a structure as possible, to create a structure that is loose enough to cover a large chunk of the board and give you influence over it and more territory than your opponent. It's an oppositional game, without being so loose that the whole thing falls apart. Mm. And I feel this is very important to me in science fiction and fantasy and in genres of world building, or in which we that word world building keeps coming up, you know, because you have to. Or we are called to, I found myself called to, create character with depth and drama, with pace and intent and eagerness, with human feeling, and yet also with an orientation to the world, giving the reader an invitation to this space that they can now start to play around in and feel around with their mind. It's a lot to do. So I find myself thinking a lot on a sentence by sentence level, what is this doing? How many different things is this accomplishing? And especially in red sections, which are in my mind so in conversation with great, you know, new wave 70s and earlier American science fiction, with like Apex Le Guin, with Ursula K. Le Guin, and with Zelazny's work, and many other writers. Those are two that really stand out in my personal canon. The work of each sentence is to suggest volumes. So in a way, there's a compression and an expansiveness of vision. It leads to a very clipped sentence because you want the reader to encapsulate the entire sentence, to like swallow it like a pill, so then it does work on them.
Huh. Yeah. I think about it, there's a concept in architecture about compression and expansion too, where you introduce someone to a compressed space so that when they come out into the more open space, Frank Lloyd Wright used this a lot, it feels like even more expansive and impressive. And I think that's something that you do in your paragraphs, Max, where you guide people in a compressed space, expand out, and then compress back down to transition out of that scene. And then Amal, your metaphor of the seashell on the beach is so perfect because I think there is something more circular and something a little bit more labyrinthine in terms of the density of how you draw people and move them through the space. And I really loved hearing both of you talk about that relationship.
Yeah, I was listening to that. I had, interestingly, a slightly different takeaway from Dong Wan about the difference between the way, what you choose to describe when you're talking about things. Because for me, one of the things about short fiction in particular is that you will often pick one image that stands in as a representation for the whole place, because you only have time to describe the one thing. And you have to leave, and then you leave space for the reader to describe everything else based on the one thing that you've described. And in novel form, I find that I can describe that thing, and I can describe several things that are in that space. And that is, that's a question of, like, what are you picking for your imagery and things like that, which is different to me from a question of cadence. They're related, but cadence to me is about sentence structure, about the rhythm of the language. So when we're talking about clipped, Dongwon, when you're talking about clipped, for Max, or for Red, Max has expressed the Red, is that there is a more mechanistic sound, a rhythm to that, mm-hmm. that cadence. Whereas as Blue has this organic lyricism, and that to me is much more about the sentence structure more than what they are choosing to describe. Like, you could describe the seashell in that clipped, mechanistic style either way, and it would express different things by the pairing of not just who is looking at what, but the way they express it. And so, you know, listener, when you're hearing us talk about, like, lyricism versus clipped or expansive, the tools that we're talking about are sentence structure and word choice, and we're talking about imagery, and we're talking about focus, and we're talking about contrast, mm-hmm. like compression, expansion. Mm-hmm. It's the contrast between two things, which is doing the work for you.
This conversation. Oh, sorry.
I picked up the book to kind of open it randomly and see if it suggested something to me about, like, an example in the book of what Mary Robinette has pointed to. And I do. I think that it is. There were two parts. Whenever I have Blue try to evoke in a letter a place, it is through a very, very, very focused sensory mechanism. When she talks about garden in this, you know, sort of deflecting but also intriguing way, she talks about eating honey and cheese or something like that, right? Like, we do have superb honey, you know, and stuff like that. When she talks about, you know, the respite that she is in when she's in, you know, a deep, uncolonized North America, she starts by saying, like, I've been needle felting for my sister's children. And it's like the focus on, like, the idea of needle felting is the thing that sort of carries me through. And I guess the one thing I want to say about voice in this instance, for my experience of writing Blue in this book, was of always looking for the thing that was going to carry me through a conversation, mm-hmm. In a way that would evoke the world and evoke contact with the world, without me necessarily knowing what world I was describing, because it's being invented, like, you know, building the runway as we are flying the plane. That's how it works, right? Anyway, sure. Yeah, if that makes any sense. But yeah,
I think this conversation could easily go on for 3 hours. I mean, this could so easily be just the longest podcast ever recorded. You three are some of my favorite people to talk to about craft, and this conversation has been truly delightful. But unfortunately, we should probably call it here. I believe the two of you have some homework for us.
We do.
Yes. So voice, quite famously, and I think as expressed on this very podcast, means a lot of different things to a lot of different people teaching and talking about voice. We can talk about, a one given author's voice. We can talk about a character voice. We can talk about affect and so on. So I wanted to kind of make a virtue of that plenitude and give you a slightly chaotic piece of homework, which is I want you to take a passage of something that you have written and rewrite it in three different ways. One, write it as if it were being sung. Two, write it as if it were being shouted. And three, write it as if it were being whispered. And that's your homework. Courtesy of Max and me collaborating on this exercise.
I love this homework so much. Excuse me. This is really great homework.
I'm not singing
great
it.
Great homework. It was just for you, Nolan.
Homework!
Just for you.
Thank you so much to both of you for joining us for this. This has been truly delightful. It's such a great way to close out this series of being able to talk to the two of you directly about so many different aspects of this.
Thank you so much for having us on. It is such an enormous compliment to get to talk to people who've read the book so deeply and to talk about it on this level. So thank you so much.
Yes, joy of a conversation. Thank you both for having us.
You're amazing. This has been Writing Excuses. You're out of excuses. Now go write.
Please rate and review us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts or your podcast platform of choice. Your ratings help other writers discover us for the first time.
Support for today's show comes from The Inner Loop Radio. If you listen to us because you're a writer, then you'll also want to listen to Rachel and Courtney talk about how to stay inspired, how to stay focused, and how to stay sane. Subscribe now to The Inner Loop Radio on iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, or any other podcasting site. Get inspired, get focused, and get lit on The Inner Loop Radio. Writing Excuses has been brought to you by our listeners, patrons, and friends. Your hosts for this episode of Writing Excuses were Mary Robinette Kowal and Dongwon Song, with special guests Amal El-Mohtar and Max Gladstone. This episode was engineered by Marshall Carr Jr., mastered by Alex Jackson, and produced by Emma Reynolds. For more information, visit writingexcuses.com.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.